This program is designed to provide general information with regards to the subject matters covered. This information is given with the understanding that neither the hosts, guests, sponsors, or station are engaged in rendering any specific and personal, medical, financial, legal, counseling, professional service, or any advice. You should seek the services of competent professionals before applying or trying any suggested ideas.
Welcome to Woodbury Reports with your host, Lon Woodbury, talking with leading professionals about how parents and others can help their struggling teens, preteens, and young adults. Now here's your host, Lon Woodbury.
Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. I'm Lon Woodbury, located in North Idaho, and here helping me is my co-host, Liz McGee from Denver. Well, good afternoon, Liz. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm fine, Lon. How are you?
I'm doing fine, and I'm looking forward to this. We're going to be talking with Doug Mahan. He's the clinical director down at Daniels Academy, and we're going to talk about working with the autism spectrum. Now, Liz, I stepped in your line a little bit there.
You want to introduce a little bit more about him? That's okay.
No, actually, though,
he is the clinical director at Daniels Academy, located in Heber City, and excellent residential treatment program. And today, we're really excited because we think that his topic is going to be of interest to a number of people about the autism spectrum. That seems to be a real hot topic lately. So take it away, Lon.
Okay. Well, one reminder is that for those of you that are listening live, to the lower right, there's a chat function. If you click on that, you can make comments, ask questions, and we'll be following that and try to get answers for you if you have a question, or read out your comments and maybe discuss them. So, Doug, let's talk about autism. What just is the autism spectrum?
Lon and Liz, thank you so much for having me on the Woodbury Report. So that's the question of the day, is what is the autism spectrum? I think that one of the great things happening right now is that there are so many studies happening that are helping us in identifying exactly all of the nuances that are part of this neurological development disorder. And so autism spectrum is it's different for a lot of different people. You have several different frequencies, durations, and information specific to an individual. And in my experience, it really is individual neurological development issues that need to be treated and worked with to allow young men, young women on the autism spectrum to gain function through skill development.
So you're saying that in the brain, there are just some connections the neurotypical person, most of us have, but that don't work as well or not there in an autistic person?
Yes. So with someone who has neural differences, typically the limbic structures are in charge of interpersonal interaction. And so one of the most important aspects of working with families and young men and women on the autism spectrum is addressing their skill development around being able to downregulate their impulses and the behaviors that interfere with being effective and healthy. And that downregulation process is important, using the intellect to be able to regulate the emotional content that is attached.
So a large part of the problem is in the prefrontal cortex. It isn't quite working as well as it should.
That's correct. And the prefrontal cortex, especially the right side, that is responsible for emotional content and the executive functioning processes. around emotion have not been developed or are being hijacked by cognitive distortions, thinking errors. And that is the last part of our brain to mature. Our brain grows from back to front. And so it's difficult for a teenager who is navigating the standard developmental processes that are involved. And then, you know, in my book, I multiply those processes by four when I'm working with young men on the autism spectrum.
Mm-hmm. And so what you're basically saying is they don't have the ability that the cortical modulation, they're not able to really do that. And tell me, what are some of the things that you see, like specific things that you see with the kids that come to you that they might be struggling with?
Okay. So here at Daniels, we focus on our clinical foundation, which is based around what we call the four pillars of Daniels. And our students typically have some type of deficit in executive function skills, daily living skills, emotion regulation, and social learning. Mm-hmm. And so everything that we do, all of the skills that we focus on, revolve around those four pillars. Mm-hmm. So the young men that usually that we see come to us with usually newly diagnosed with the autism spectrum and with a history of being misunderstood. Mm-hmm. and with a history of treatment modalities that have not been effective for them.
What treatment modalities would that be? I'm just curious if you could kind of educate our audience as to what hasn't worked for these kids in the past.
You bet. So one of the issues is insight-oriented therapies are not typically effective with individuals whose executive function skills are either compromised or they don't have the neural pathways developed through skill development to be able to gain lasting insight and sustain it. And so, you know, the issue is the internalization of the skills and then the generalization of those skills into their community.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask something on a sort of a comparison, because one thing you sent us that said that oftentimes they'll come with an oppositional defiant disorder, but that's not opposition, it's rigidity. And you talk about executive functioning and poor executive functioning. Well, that sounds like that applies to a ADHD kid also, but I'm sure there's a big difference going on. Could you sort of differentiate between those three?
Okay, so I hope I understood your question correctly, Lon.
So, well, if not, talk anyway. And then we'll focus better.
Alpha there you go. So our students come to us typically with a diagnosis of oppositional defiant disorder. And one of the things that we've learned about the young men that we work with is that opposition is not an intentional cognitive process. Some parts of it can be, but usually it's part of the autism spectrum and the rigidity that comes along with that. So not having navigated past that concrete operational stage in development. And so having that rigidity in place where they're not able to make shifts, they're not able to see options that are available. And so they really struggle with opposition, and rigidity.
A question on that. Is a rigidity a sort of defensive because they've gotten crossways before, or is it something else?
That definitely is a contributing factor to the rigidity. And it is a safety-seeking behavior. The limbic structures are responsible to keep us safe. They do that physically, and they do that psychologically. So the unconscious mind working to keep us safe. And so the young men that we typically see have a history of being or feeling very unsafe. And so providing a predictable environment for them is essential they can diminish those limbic structure responses.
And I imagine that a lot of these young men, I mean, they just sound like, at least from the students that I've seen as well, they're very misunderstood. And oftentimes I think that they come across professionals in their lives, whether they be teachers or therapists, or where, you know, if they don't understand what's going on with them, they tend to see their behaviors as willful and all the time. And when oftentimes that's not the case, is that correct?
That is correct. So their rigidity does come across as willfulness. And so working with them on willingness, being able to make shifts, that's an absolutely essential skill for us to be functional in society, is being able to recognize those things. And so they do come to us misunderstood and really labeled as oppositional. When we start working with them, it's, holy cow, wow, someone understands me, you get it. You understand what my world is like. And because of their rigidity, they do develop perceptual differences and perceive things very differently than you or I would perceive them. Mm-hmm. And so until they feel heard, they're not willing to let go of that rigidity and start to develop skills to move forward in life.
Mm-hmm. Are they oftentimes targets for bullying too, do you find?
Yes. Yes. And then what we see is that so the young men that I work with typically will have an overdeveloped sense of fairness. Mm-hmm. And so they really have this desire for everything to be fair. And if someone teases them, that really feels to them as bullying. And so there are a lot of categories where bullying, per se, really impacts individuals on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. Because of their perceptual differences. It's very difficult for them to identify the intent of the person that's interacting with them. And so it becomes an issue for them. And what we see is once they move out of a really unsafe environment, that they may, because those are social interactions that have happened in their lives, that they may in turn participate in that behavior so that they're not the ones being bullied. And so it's important for us to be able to work with them and teach skills on interpersonal effectiveness so that they don't repeat the same behaviors and repeat the social processes that they know and that they are intimately and have been engaged in their life by being bullied.
Let me change the focus a little bit on how it's like, the question, basic question, and then maybe I'd like to share a little story, but how is working with boys on the spectrum different than working with kids with other needs, with other problems, you know, the struggling teens in general? And my story is I was down there last week, had a chance to visit Daniel's Academy, and I went into lunch, and so the image was sort of, this is what you see with a group of spectrum boys, a little quirky. It was pretty healthy in the long run, but it was sort of funny. I sat down at lunch. There was four other kids and one staff to have lunch and, you know, a chance to talk to the kids. A kid to the left of me, no eye contact, didn't say a word. I understood he was having a rough day. Okay, no contact, the sense there. Two of the other kids got up, took their lunch, and went off to another table. I guess they didn't know how to deal with a stranger. And if I hadn't known better, I could have been insulted by that. But I think it was just a situation. They didn't know how to deal with a stranger or what to say, so they avoided that situation. But so how is it working with these boys?
So working with these young men, first of all, there's nothing I'd rather do. I really love these young men, and I love them as individuals, and because they have these challenges that they face, and a lot of the social interactive, that reciprocity piece of responding in an intimate situation where you sit down and engage, and it is very difficult. It is very difficult, and so you'll see the students here be at different levels in their development. So some of our newer students and who are beginning to work on skill development, and that's really where the main difference is that we're working with some very basic baseline social processes, executive function skills, social learning, and emotion regulation, and ego challenges. So before we can really get to pain management and distress management. Skill development around the executive functioning processes needs to occur at some level so that when they are in distress, they are able to find a healthy way through that distress. And so it is very difficult for them to engage socially when they have a history of social rejection, when they have a history of failure, and their self-esteem, their self-worth is very low because those are the messages of failure that they receive. You know, this works with everyone else. What's wrong with you? And so, you know, they get that message whether verbally or non-verbally. And a lot of our students do have incredible verbal skills and incredible personal presentation skills. A lot of them do lack the interpersonal effectiveness that comes along with that to be able to sustain a relationship. And so we are working on the basic skills for them to be able to accomplish that and be effective and healthy.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about, you know, teaching the social skills, can you describe, you know, what that looks like? What would some of the techniques be that you would use?
You bet. So we have individual therapy, we have process groups, and then we have activities with each other. We have specific behaviors that we would like to see them engage in that tell us where they're at in their skill development and growth in the milieu. And so what we look for with them is in that skill development is how they're interacting with each other. So we want them to internalize those skills. And then as a program, we believe it's essential for these young men on the autism spectrum to engage in the local community. And so our goal is for these young men to be able to be out in the community, to have those interactions with community members where they can practice those skills. And then we, you know, that's a very unpredictable environment, and there's a lot of risk that goes into taking young men who are in a residential treatment center into the community every day for them to be able to practice their skills with the unsuspecting locals. So, we face situations in the moment. We do a lot of in the moment coaching. And so the specific skills that we're trying to engender in these young men, we identify each week in our treatment team. And so a standard skill would be the dialectical behavior therapy skill of the Dear Man, which is an acronym that allows them to get their needs met in a healthy way. So they practice that continually. So that interpersonal effectiveness piece, and also another one that works well with our young men, is another acronym called GIVE. You know, be gentle, act interested, validate the other person, so the active listening piece, and then have an easy manner. And so we work constantly on modeling those skills and helping the students engage in healthy ways so that they do generalize those skills into the community. And, it's a really important process for them. If we were to isolate them here, that generalization would not happen. We'd be able to internalize those skills with the young men. But without that practice, that constant practice, it's really difficult for them to generalize those skills across different situations because of their rigidity.
Let me put this into a little bit of context and refer to the DSM-5, which is sort of the diagnostical Bible. It's a little bit controversy, but I understand that there's a level one on the spectrum. There's level one, level two, and level three. And level one are what you work with. These are kids that are sort of functioning and can learn things. Level two and level three get more to the classical autism, totally non-communicative, and you don't work with those. You work with the ones that are fairly light on the whole spectrum. Could you clarify that a little bit?
You bet. So the young men that we work with will typically have, under the old classification system, would have been Asperger's, nonverbal learning disorder, or high-functioning autism. And also, you know, you mentioned earlier ADHD. So the executive functioning processes for young men with severe ADHD also are hijacked by brain activity and cognitive distortions. And so it's a very similar process. So the young men that we work with would have, a lot of them actually, their parents believed them to be gifted when they were younger, and then things went south, and there's that loss of dreams piece for them. And so, you know, part of the process in sustaining families is helping those dreams become realities again, because they are gifted and they do have unlimited potential. And so it's really important for us to be able to take the family system and move it in a positive direction, teach the parents the skills along with the young men that we work with. And it really does come down to looking at what's right for that individual in that family system, because each of them are, you know, while the DSM provides that guideline, we look at the individual as, you know, where are they at in their capacity to be able to interact in the community as we're there on a consistent basis. We're involved in the community doing service. We're involved in the community at the rec center, and they are involved going shopping for things. And so it really is important for them to have the ability to learn the skills and to effectively manage them. So we use cognitive behavioral techniques, trying to help them recognize where that their cognition can downregulate their impulses, and they can manage through situations that in the past were very painful to them. And so and there's a process of them gaining that trust in those skills and those abilities. And so it's not a linear equation from arriving into a treatment center that uses this modality and then, you know, just improving. It's a process of them internalizing as well, which is, you know, I know, you know, they I'm sure they don't say this to themselves, but it's a process that happens. They know that this, what they used before, was effective, mm-hmm. even though it was destructive and painful for those around them and for themselves. It was effective in getting their needs met.
Well, you know, one of our listeners is asking a question. I think this is a real interesting question, too. Is this a lifelong process?
It is a lifelong process. It is. Because it's a neural development issue, you know, our brains are fluid, and they experience growth. Typically, they experience growth across our lifetimes and neural changes, things that are no longer that we're actively involved in, you know, are moved to the back of to the back of our awareness. And so, you know, we're constantly changing. And one of the challenges for the young men that we work with is that effort has to be sustained. That mm-hmm. effort has to be sustained for them in order for them to be effective across their lifetime. So there's not a point where they can say, I've arrived in my mm-hmm. skill development. You know, as they mature, things change for them, but if they have that foundation of skills, they have ways of learning to be effective.
Now, could you talk a little bit, go sort of back to the basics here, the brain development? One thing when we were talking, when I was talking with you last week, and you mentioned oftentimes the kids appear to be gifted the first couple of years and then it goes south. So what happens? What you had explained was something different happens in their brain development than happens in the typical, neurotypical kid. Could you explain a little bit about that and how it develops to where they are on the spectrum, the brain?
You bet. Yeah, and so the information that I'm going to talk about is from a couple of different studies. And, you know, right now in the autism field, we don't have enough replication of the studies right now to know anything for certain. But what I see and what appears to be the process, and from some of the information that's out there from functional MRI studies, is that there's phenomenal brain growth about the first 2 years of life. And then there's a pruning process. And the nonverbal processes seem to be pruned. And so, you know, the interactions that 2-year-old, that 18-month-old are having with the world are visual and verbal. And so some of the other processes seem to be eliminated at time. And then there are new studies that show that there may not be any pruning at all after that. And so it's really interesting, you know, what's out there. And you can imagine what it would be like if you were never able to let go of information that wasn't essential for you and for your safety. And, you know, a lot of it, too, is the sensory information coming in for these young men is it's a threat. So their limbic structures are directly connected to their central nervous system. So before they even have a chance to think about it, that emotional content is hitting their bodies. And so that's why that downregulation skills development is essential, so that they can downregulate that central nervous system response. And so anxiety is huge. They've developed these self-defense processes where anxiety keeps them safe, but they're also not able to eliminate things in their environment that aren't unsafe.
So basically, you're teaching them how to handle all of this. You mentioned the four pillars in your material, the basic elements in working with spectrum kids. Could you tell us what those four pillars are? And we've talked a little bit about some of them, the community part. But could you tell us what the four pillars are and maybe a little bit more definition of why it's important? Each one is
you bet.
One.
You bet. So executive function skills. There are a lot of executive functioning skills out there. With our young men, we work with them on their vocabulary and their understanding, and we lump all of the executive functioning processes into four areas just to simplify it. So we have them focus on flexibility, being able to make those shifts, and then perseverance, not quitting on being effective, because they have a history of self-defeat and defeat around neurotypical processes. And so that perseverance piece and learning those skills of how not to give up when things get difficult are very important. And then we talk with them about initiation, being able to independently move forward. And there are a lot of different things that I'm not covering in these four areas, but initiation and inhibition are really important. So inhibition is around impulsive awareness and being able to think before you act, and to feel before you act, or to feel without acting. And so we do focus on skills that help our students be able to understand their limbic impact and how to downregulate those limbic structures and those processes.
And okay, you mentioned four pillars. Could you itemize what the four pillars are?
You bet. Executive function skills, daily living skills, emotion regulation, and social learning. So the daily living, so is it okay if I move to the daily living skills, Lon?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, so the daily living skills, personal hygiene, personal presentation, environmental adaptations, transition skills. Our young men struggle with being able to make transitions, and that has to do with the executive functioning processes around flexibility. And then organizing personal belongings, organizing personal space, work skills, vocational skills, being able to effectively participate in the classroom and school. And then around emotion regulations, it's being able to first be able to identify what exactly am I feeling? And it's incredible. We use a tool called the mixed emotion cards with these young men, and they are shocked at how many emotions that they are experiencing in a single moment in time when they're in distress. And so it's important for them to be able to see that and identify what's happening with them. And if they can identify what's happening with them with their emotional content, then they're able to face those emotions. And we tell them that emotions are like dogs. If you face them, you know, if you've got a dog growling at you, right? If you face it, you know, it'll back down and go away. But if you run from it, it'll catch you and eat you. And so, you know, it's really important, first of all, to be able to identify what your experience is. You've had people tell you your whole life what your experience should be, but it's important for these young men to be able to identify it for themselves, what their emotional experience is. What am I experiencing? How can I find a healthy way to face those. And with them, I call it walking through their wreckage, you know, looking at their past situations where they really struggled or their current situations where they're struggling, being able to stare it in the face, to face those realities that are so difficult to face. And, you know, our instinct is to protect them from painful things. But in reality, we need to be able to help them face realities in their lives. The realities, you know, that were mentioned earlier, that this is a lifelong process. That's hard to face. And, you know, facing that reality in a healthy way is difficult. So,
well, one part of it is engaging the parents and the siblings in all of this. How do you do that? Or what do the parents and the siblings need to learn at the same time that that your students are learning?
So the parents and the siblings, first of all, we usually start with the parents, and we get the parents speaking the same language that we're speaking in, and with the skill development processes that their son is going through. So we ask them to work on those same skills, to be able to think about those skills that we're working on. And we have them practice those skills with their son. And it's a fun process to watch, and how communication processes are improved. Perceptual understanding is improved. A lot of times, you know, especially as parents and teaching our children, we want them to share our perception. You know, there's this shared perceptual identity in culture.
I bet there's a lot of unlearning you need to do with the parents too.
There is, but we prefer to tackle that with teaching skills and allowing them to the strengths. You know, these parents have a lot of times been through the ringer, and they've actually developed skills that they've set aside because of the intensity of the situations that they're in with their children. You know, when our stress levels go up, we become more primitive and our responses become more primitive. And so parents have usually, you know these skills. And then when they finally get to sleep at night, when their son is here and safe, and they're finally able to sleep at night and knowing that their son is safe, then they're able to start focusing and looking back. And, you know, hopefully they're taking that journey with our therapists as well, where they're looking at the skills that they developed through that process of just surviving what was happening in the family system.
So how often do you find in these families that you see this young man and he's diagnosed on the spectrum, and you meet the parents, and how often do you see that maybe one of them or both of them are on the spectrum? How often does that seem to happen?
Well, it's, you know, I wouldn't want to diagnose the parents, but there are system issues. So when you face rigidity, you tend to become more rigid yourself. So when the family system is in an unhealthy pattern of drawing lines in the sand, this person that you're trying to deal with has drawn this line in the sand, and so, like, no, this is the way it's going to be. And I call that, you know, what hill do you want to die on? Is this Custer's last stand, right? Mm-hmm. Where, you know, this is what you have to do. And so being able to be flexible while maintaining boundaries is a skill that, and a process that parents need to be able to move back to. And a lot of the parents that we work with have those skills, but they've had to move away from them to be able to survive what was happening. And so, you know, taking that process and bringing it out in the open and saying, okay, in the family system, these are the unhealthy patterns. These are the realities that you were facing and that you're still facing. And these are the realities that we need to find a healthy way through. So there are patterns that can be shifted with flexibility and with perseverance to become healthy that were unhealthy because of the way things were happening, but you can shift some of those patterns into healthy patterns. And so, you know, the strength of the young men that we work with are their families and their dedicated parents. Mm-hmm. And usually the parents are so invested in the young men that a lot of times it's been their life. And so it's hard to kind of take a step back and go, okay, this is, you know, this has been so intense for so long. and, okay, now I need to take a step back and reevaluate.
So they must,
and try to move forward.
They must come to you feeling really hopeless and, you know, oftentimes like, is anything going to ever change? You know, is my child going to have a normal existence? You know, whatever that might be. That they must come to you pretty exhausted and hopeless.
Yes, yeah, that is common. And, you know, it's important to recognize that they are exhausted. They are exhausted, and they've been, you know, the family system has had a history of defeat. You know, hey, this worked with my other children. Why isn't it working with, you know, and the professionals were telling me this should work with my son, and the school districts are trying to do it, and it's not working. And so there's this history of defeat and hopelessness. And I always, when I work with the families, I try to help them recognize that, you know, there are expectations that when we don't meet those expectations as human beings, there's only one possible emotional response, and that's the emotions surrounding failure. And so moving the family system away from the expectations and into the hopes, you know, we hope that our son is able to develop these skills that he needs to be able to be functional so that he can reach his full potential, so that he can be able to do what he loves to do in his life and have a good quality of life.
Let me ask about the academics on that, because you are a school and can grant a degree if appropriate. But it seemed to me like, to a large extent, especially in the academics, it was experiential. You know, project-based learning is very important there. But it seems like the whole thing, it's as you say, the talk therapy doesn't work so very well. So a lot of experience, and I presume that goes with the family too, in experiencing this so they can learn and adjust. Crap, am I on the right track?
Yes, you bet. Yeah, experience is key, and how we manage those experiences. We either manage those experiences in a healthy way, or we manage those experiences in an unhealthy way, and they contribute to us, or they move us in the wrong direction in our ability to be effective. And so definitely hands-on things work extremely well with the young men that we work with. It helps them see the concept. A lot of the students that we have in our school have very high IQs and very low processing speeds. And so being able to help them access the phenomenal minds that they do have is really important in their process, in their treatment process, which is why we are a school as well. And these four pillars that we have are functional across the whole system. And so the academic goals are also tied in with the four pillars that we're working on, so that we have that focus with the young men. So their ability to understand and to produce the projects that they produce, I stand in awe at the end of each semester as our young men take the concepts that they've learned in their classes and present a project to their parents and to the school as part of their final. And so it was really fun. The last semester, our students created a mini golf course, so they had to do all of the math associated with that. And then they had to tie it with a World War II theme. So it was really interesting as they learned about the history and had to apply the math. So those projects really engage them. And they focus and attend when it's hands-on and when the teachers understand to how to help them pass that deficit of processing speed. Mm-hmm. A lot of our students have, you know, they're operating in fast, what I call fast brain. So they're on autopilot. And mm-hmm. so being able to slow them down so that they're able to, when they slow down, their brain doesn't stutter. and they get lost in trying to figure something out because they've had to slow down their minds. And they have very active minds, and they go 100 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And so getting them to be able to attend and focus on things is really essential. And that project-based learning and the experiential learning that we do our students go skiing during the winter and do those things that are physically active to help with fine motor skills as well, which is another issue with the young men that we work with. And so it's really, the way that it ties together for me is in those four main areas that we have, the four pillars. So
if the kid was supposed to do some carpentry thing or tying flies or something in the culture of the fine motor skills, typically they have a problem with that and they need work on the fine motor skills, doing close work, correct?
Yes, they do. Yeah, a lot of our students have, they appear to be very functional. Some of them do have, quirkiness, but it's very, they are functional, but those fine motor pieces, I had a student who needed help putting his earrings. He needed help putting the earrings on because he couldn't get the back of the earring post and the secure to be able to attach effectively. His fingers were just not capable of doing that. And so it's important that, as part of that experiential process, that our students are gaining that piece as well and being able to recognize what their limitations are and how to adapt to those limitations.
Is that a permanent limitation, or is it something just for whatever reason, their lifestyle, they haven't had that practice that would bring that about, or is it both?
It depends on the severity of the fine motor skills. We see phenomenal things, especially if those fine motor skills are attended to by an occupational therapist or other fine motor skills around speech with a speech therapist at a young age. The benefit of that is just incredible, and continuing those processes throughout their development, I feel, is essential. A lot of our students have sensory issues and have, sensory overload because they're not able to diminish the impact of their sensory information. We have our five external senses, but we also have internal senses, compression and pressure, flexion and tension, those processes that are constantly happening within us as well. And it can be extremely overwhelming. So, we have a place in our home called the chill zone, where they can just go and all of the external sensory input is diminished and allows them to be able to kind of catch up with processing the sensory information that they've been experiencing.
Mm-hmm. What about? Go ahead. Oh, well, I was going to say, it's. I imagine a lot of the kids that you see, and because they've probably been misdiagnosed or they weren't diagnosed properly at all, have a lot of them been on medication? And do you find that once they're with you for a while, they're not in as much need of medication anymore?
We do. And it is, we're very careful with that process. We have a psychiatrist that works with us. She's triple board certified and is, very skilled in working with adolescents. And so one of our processes, it's not our main goal to diminish medication, but as our students develop skills, they're able to manage anxiety in healthier ways. And they may not be able to go off of their anxiety medications or the other medications they've been on. But we definitely look at that closely. And because we are a residential treatment center, we're able to observe them. And so, we do get young men that are on excessive amounts of medication that have been tried in the past to manage behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so our psychiatrist, Dr. Stoney, is very adept at looking at those things and recognizing when changes need to happen. And she meets with each therapist over each student that she meets and talks with the residential staff as well.
Good. Very interesting.
How do you measure the effectiveness of the skills being practiced? Is it a gut feeling, or you have some objective measurement tools, or how do you know when it's working?
We do have objective measurement tools. So our staff have... information that they're looking for each shift that they work, and then they do a report with that. That gives the therapist the information that they need to be able to focus on skill development. So if I'm working with a young man who is trying skills around interrupting an impulse or recognizing when he's becoming emotional and when he's moving into emotion mind, we're able to get information that allows us to see where they're at. And the most valuable information that we do have is when the student is in distress, are they using those skills? Or as they're moving into distress, are they choosing to experiment with those skills? And if they experiment successfully, are they using that skill again? And we encourage them to use that skill again if they found success, to make adjustments where they need them. And so the evidence that they give us are their interpersonal interactions with members in the community, their interpersonal actions with our staff, with the teachers, with the other students in the milieu. And so what we focus on those four pillar areas of what are they giving us? What is their reality? And we're able to take that. And as our students grow, we increase the privileges and the responsibilities that they have. And it really is important for them to take those responsibilities, to initiate and be independent and learn to be independent. And we typically know that our student is going to be successful when we've seen them use those skills at a high level for about 6 months. And so it's a frustrating process, because it really does come down to, if I'm able to use these skills at a high level and demonstrate them when I'm in an unpredictable environment. So our students typically will have more access to the community as they gain more responsibilities. And so it doesn't diminish their distress. It increases their ability to trust the skills that they've gained and trust that those skills are going to sustain them. And when I've done this for a long time, and that's my favorite. That's my favorite part of watching these young men grow, is when they make that shift into trusting those skills, and then they take off. Lon, Liz, they just take off, and it's fun to watch. It really
okay,
is.
Okay, we have about 2-3 minutes left, and wanted to have you a chance to talk a little bit about Daniels Academy, so I guess you could call this your commercial break. What ages do you work with? It's all boys.
How many is it?
Yeah, how many do you have? How are you planning to grow? Tell us a little bit about Daniels Academy, and then we'll have to wrap it up.
You bet. So at Daniels Academy, we serve young men who are 13 to 18. We do, in the state of Utah, have a variance process where we're able to work with students over the age of 18 for while they're still enrolled in school. And so we do that as well with the young men. So, and we work with young men who, because we're in the community on a daily basis, can't have aggression and have active behavioral issues, because they are in the community. They're in the rec center, around other high school students, around small children using the rec center for their PE class. And so it's important that they have the ability to sustain and find a healthy way through some difficult things. So those are the young men that we typically work with. On the autism spectrum, level 1 and related conditions like ADHD that have compromised the executive functioning processes.
And if somebody was interested or had a question, how would they get a hold of you?
So if someone has a question, they would call Sean, our admissions director, and his name is Sean Haggerty, and the phone number is, and I apologize, my apparatus, my trusty phone number finder, my electronic brain has deserted me. And the phone number that I had for you is not in my hands right now.
I have it, though. I'll tell you what it is.
Thank you so much, Liz. Thank you so much.
You can reach Sean Haggerty at 801-425-5155.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, and how about if they wanted to talk to you? Could they call your cell phone?
They can't. They can call myself. So my number is on the website. It's 801-362-3565. And they can reach me.
And your website URL?
It's danielsacademy.net.
Okay, well, that's we ran out of time. We could go on for quite a while longer. But this is Lon Woodbury with Liz McGee. Been talking with Doug Mahan, working with the Autism Spectrum, and he's a clinical director at Daniels Academy. Thank you very much. This has been great.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on today.